Welcome back to Two-Way Talk here on Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And I'm Kara Williams.
We are talking about housing policy and the affordable housing crisis in the United States. We are blessed to have with us Dennis C. Shea, the executive director of the J. Ronald Terwilliger Center for Housing Policy. His past work with the bipartisan group includes serving as a consultant to the BPC's Blue Ribbon Housing Commission and its Senior Health and Housing Task Force. In these roles, he contributed to two landmark reports, Housing America's Future, New Directions for National Policy and Healthy Aging Begins at Home, during the administration of President George W. Bush. Shea served as the Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Dennis Shea, welcome to Two-Way Talk.
Thank you, Anthony. It's great to be with you this afternoon.
It's great to have you here. Now, it's very interesting because we talk about housing and affordable housing constantly on this program and focusing on city issues that are very important to our listeners. Why should housing be a top priority issue at the federal government level?
Well, that's a great question. In our view at the BPC and with the Terwilliger Center, housing is obviously a basic necessity of life, right? Shelter.
Uh-huh.
We all need shelter. But it's a lot more than that. Research has clearly demonstrated that there are many different connections between having a safe and affordable home to issues like health, your own mental and physical health. Also, if you're stably housed, you're probably tapping the healthcare system less, and it could reduce healthcare costs.
Mm.
If you live in a stable, affordable home in a good community, it could lead to better academic performance by children, which could have a lifetime of benefits. So our view is that yes, housing is a basic necessity of life because it provides shelter that everyone needs. But it also is very much connected to a variety of different pathways in life, healthcare, education, just named a couple of them. So we think it's vitally important to make sure that every family, every household in America, this is our aspiration, has access to a stable and affordable home.
Mm.
So that's what we're shooting for. As you mentioned, there's a crisis. Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Affordable housing crisis. And people are paying rents that they cannot afford.
That's right.
And many people are, one paycheck from eviction, correct? So we see the problem as being twofold, having really two dimensions. One on the supply side, the supply dimension, and the other on the demand side, the demand dimension. On the supply, there's just not enough supply of affordable rental homes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One estimate says there is a 7 million unit shortage of affordable rental homes for the lowest income households in the United States. So it's, obviously these shortages lead to higher rental costs.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at Baltimore, for example, more than half of Baltimore renters pay more than 30% of their income on rent.
On rent. Wow.
And about, on rent, housing costs,
mm-hmm.
rental housing costs. And about one in three are spending more than 50% of their income on rent. So when you're spending that much money for your housing, you have to make difficult trade-offs between do I pay for housing or do I pay for food, nutritious food, do I pay for some prescription drugs I need, or more health care I need, or do I give my child a little extra tutoring help, or whatever, on education. So when you're paying so much, when housing costs consume so much of your income, it makes families and households, force them into difficult decisions. And, of course, these costs impact the lower income families and households in America, and in Baltimore more than anybody else.
Mm.
So that's the supply side. Demand is You know, we have housing assistance programs. The Housing Choice Voucher Program is one, which provides, bridges the gap between paying 30% of your income for rent and the rent of the unit you're trying to get access to. And unfortunately, there's not enough resources out there to fund vouchers for eligible households. And according to our analysis, and it's widely shared by others, one in five households who are eligible for the program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program, get it. So there's a lot of households and families who are being shut out of the program simply because there's not enough resources. So I understand as of March 2021, the Housing Authority of Baltimore City was not even accepting applications to be on the wait list for the Housing Choice Voucher Program. It's oversubscribed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're saying, we think, you know, at the beat, we're bipartisan. We have Republicans, we have Democrats working with us, and we all are committed to the view that housing is so important that we need to make it a higher priority in our politics, in our public policy making here in Washington and abroad, so and throughout the country. So that's where we're coming from, Anthony.
Wow.
So what are some of the primary? I'm sorry.
No,
was he talking?
Ahead.
Oh, okay. Yes. Hi. How are you? What are some of the primary barriers to progress in increasing the number of Americans with stable housing?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, on the supply side, there's just private market rate developers. You know, the private companies, private developers that are, you know, making apartment buildings, for example, just building apartment buildings at market rate.
Mm-hmm.
They will not build apartments for lower-income households because the math doesn't work for them. The economics doesn't work. So there is a program called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, which is a tax credit that is allocated to the states, and then the states give it to private developers who make a commitment to build affordable housing for lower-income families. And so this is a very successful program. It produces about 100,000, 110,000 units. It not only builds but also preserves apartments that are decent apartments for lower-income families. But there's just not enough money devoted to that. So we support the expansion of that program to ensure that it's producing more homes for lower-income families. So that's something that's on the table right now in Congress. Another issue is just regulations, exclusionary zoning, density requirements, you know, basically local and state zoning and land use requirements that make it hard to increase costs for developers to build homes, and that cost obviously gets passed along to the family or person renting the house. So, you know, we're trying to encourage local communities to take a more open view and to try to help remove many of these regulatory barriers to building affordable homes.
So
this has been an issue for a long time, but we're still at it.
So we see a lot of the social divide in politics on this program, our callers, and certainly if we're watching and observing Washington, there seem to be deep political divides. Do you think there's a potential for affordable housing to become a priority issue for both Democrats and Republicans? And where do we find that common ground? Where do we find room to compromise there?
Okay, that's a great question. You know, at the BPC, you know, you've been obviously reading about this reconciliation process going on in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's about $300 billion devoted to housing in that process. Now, the BPC, we're bipartisan, so we feel that using that process is basically not appropriate because it just, when the other party takes over, they'll use it to undo what you did, right, or what the previous party did. So there really needs to be, it really needs to be a more of a bipartisan
Most
approach
definitely.
To this problem, because it's the only bipartisanship will create durable solutions. But the good news is, if you look at a lot of the little, each of the provisions that are in, being considered in housing in the reconciliation bill, there are not many of them that have bipartisan support.
Mm.
There is bipartisan support for expanding the low-income housing tax credit. There is bipartisan support for reinvesting in public housing stock, which mm-hmm. is an important source of affordable housing. There's bipartisan support for that. There's bipartisan support for removing unnecessary regulations that add cost and time to building homes. So there is, we just did a poll, which I think we should have a blog describing it on our BPC website at bipartisanpolicy.org, that shows that there's really Republicans and Democrats, there's a lot of room to come together on.
Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a real broad common ground that they can really build on.
There is. I mean, homelessness, for example. I mean, that has been an issue. It's a disgrace that we have so many people homeless in the United States, right?
Amen.
I you talk to Republicans, they want to help there. So we need to figure this problem out. There are approaches that have worked. Supportive housing first, putting people in a stable home initially, and then providing the support services while they're in that home, and, you know, lo and behold, the cost of all that is much lower than if that person is out on the street and going to the, you know, the emergency rooms and, you know, tapping other social services. So, I mean, I worked in the Bush administration, there's strong support back in the day, you know, there's strong support for dealing with the homelessness issue. So we just, you know, we just need to elevate this issue more on the national agenda and mm-hmm. really, and, you know, try to get people together, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, and just really try to find the common ground on this. And I think there's a broad swath of common ground on this, and we just need to advance. Because too many people are hurting. Housing affordability is a major issue in communities, you know, throughout the country. I mean, let's talk about first-time home ownership, too. I mean, there's just a tremendous shortage of homes that are affordable and available to people who want to become first-time homebuyers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's something called the Neighborhood Home Investment Act, which is also bipartisan, okay? That's a legislation that would provide a tax incentive to a developer who wants to rehab or build a home in a distressed community that's affordable to lower and moderate income people. Right now, that developer, it doesn't make economic sense for that person, mm-hmm. the developer, to do that. But with a tax incentive, it would. So, but that has bipartisan support. So we're just trying to raise at the Twilliger Center, which just officially launched today, and you know, at the Bipartisan Policy Center more generally, we really strongly believe that, you know, housing is something that's so important for all of our futures, and, mm-hmm. and it's in our national interest to make sure as many of our families as possible are stably and affordably housed.
So, Dennis, before the pandemic hit, there was a 7 to 15 year waiting list for the voucher program. Do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think, or more? And I think when I did the study on it was up to 20 years. But before that, it was like 7 to 15 years.
In Baltimore.
So do you think that the pandemic and the money going to those displaced during the pandemic had anything to do with the voucher program being halted?
No, I just think before the pandemic, there was just not enough funding for the voucher program. Mm-hmm. One in five households only who are eligible got it. So there's a hole because there's just limited resources. You know, many more people qualify for, many more households qualify for the resources available. That's why housing authorities create these wait lists and lotteries to get it. So, I mean, there just needs to be, it's proven to be a good program. It could always be improved. But we need to, you know, develop, you know, in our view at the BPC, we need to have more resources devoted to the voucher program so that more households can access and benefit from the program.
We want to invite our listeners to join in. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask Dennis Shea, just give us a call at 410-319-8888 to join the conversation here at Two Way Talk. Gene is calling from Pikesville. Gene, welcome to Two Way Talk.
Yeah, how is everyone?
Hey there, how are you?
Yeah, fine, thank you. So I have a question. Dr. King was clear in when he spoke of low-income housing and what that was in reference to the poor. But I hear these terms, low-income mm-hmm. and affordable housing. And I think it's for me, it's confusing because I don't understand the difference. And also, are you all familiar with NARAB?
No.
Well, okay. NARAB is an organization. It's the Black Real Estate
organization.
Okay.
Yes,
that's NARAB. Are you familiar with NARAB?
Yes, I've talked to people from NARAB before. Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Okay, because a close friend of mine was just elected I think it's the Northeast Region Vice President for NARAB.
Okay.
And I have discussions with her about real estate. So could you explain, please, the difference between affordable housing
and low-income
housing?
Yeah, thank you, Gene.
Thank you,
Gene. I appreciate
Gene.
You calling.
Sure. That's a great question. Thank you. You know, the federal government has a standard that HUD uses that it says if you spend 30% or less of your monthly income or housing, then it is by definition affordable. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a federal standard. So if you spend more than 30% of your income on housing, then you are considered burdened by your housing costs. Mm-hmm. If you spend more than 50% of your income on housing, you're considered severely burdened. And there are about 25% of the renters today in the United States are severely burdened by their housing costs. So it's really a huge, huge problem. So that's what we mean by affordability. There's this 30% standard that's become sort of the standard that the federal government uses. Low income is meaning, okay, so you build an apartment that would be, or a home that would be affordable to a person making a certain income level. Now, income levels are determined by something called the area median income. It's crazy, you know, it's very technical. Mm-hmm. But if you make like 50% or of the area median income, you're considered very low income. If you make 30% in your income, that's 30% of the average median income, or the median income in your area, you're considered extremely low income. So you could have affordable homes for low-income people based upon, you know, where they live. It's to be quite decent, you know, decent mm-hmm. homes. So that's what we mean. And the way HUD determines is basically on whether someone's low-income is based on geography. You know, what is their income in relation to the neighbors, right? So if you have 60% of the area median income, you're considered low income. If you have 100% or 150%, your income's say 150% of the area median income, you're not low income. Mm-hmm. You're, you know, probably moderate or a little more than moderate income. So that's how it works. It's just standards that people have developed over time.
Let's go back to the phones before we run out of time. Let's go to Dwayne calling from right here in Baltimore City. Dwayne, welcome to Two Way Talk.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call. You know, if we're going to have political conversations in reference to the poor, you know, we can't ignore the fact that one of our political parties goes out of its way to demonize the poor, okay? And so if their attitude is to demonize the poor and have done so for many years now, and also making poverty and people who are downtrodden as a moral issue, as a moral failing, then there's no way that we can get to, you know, a political solution that's going to be viable to really address the problem. So I know that's kind of nebulous, but I think that we can't ignore that basic fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, Dwayne, I respect your opinion. I certainly respect your opinion on this issue. Thanks for calling in and giving us your perspective on this. Now, Dennis, now the CDC had a lot of things in place because of the pandemic. One of the things was the eviction moratorium that was recently struck down by the United States Supreme Court. A lot of people are in now danger and risk of eviction. What are the damaging effects? Because it's much broader than just people being able to stay in their home or not be, or landlord being able to evict them. What are some of the damaging effects that an eviction can have on families and on communities?
Well, it's, can you imagine being, I've never been evicted. I cannot imagine not having a place to live, you know, waking up one day and being told you can't live here anymore and not knowing exactly where to go. So obviously evictions have tremendously negative impacts on family stability, on emotional state, mental states of people. If there are children involved, it can be, you know, really a scarring experience in their lives, lack of stability, going into homelessness, affects, obviously will affect this for kids, will affect their school life. So it's just a, you know, it's a tremendous problem, and you know, it's we need to work on this. Unfortunately, the money was sent out. You know, there's a lot of money appropriated.
There really was.
Dollars. Yeah,
and there's a lot of money in the city of Baltimore that has not been handed out or given out. It's crazy.
Yeah, and we found we did this poll, and just a lot of people were not aware of the program. This is a nationally the grant people received. Government agencies receiving the money just weren't equipped to distribute it in a timely fashion. You know, there's a concern about fraud. So how do you balance concern about fraud with the need to get the money out? And many potential applicants didn't have, you know, access to the internet, or were just not equipped to put together the paperwork to, you know, file an application. So we got to work on this. And evictions are really not a good thing at all. So it's just something we're very concerned about at the BPC.
So unfortunately, you know, Dennis, we're out of time. Music you hear coming up in the background means that we've got to move on. I really appreciate you discussing such an important issue with us. Thanks for joining us. Dennis Shea is Executive Director of the J. Ronald Terwilliger Center for Housing Policy. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Anthony.
Take care.
Thank you. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute.